The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. Greetings, my dear listeners. It is that time of year that we are finally getting loose of winter's chilly hold, and the weather beckons us to feel the warm sun on our faces and the cool water on our feet. Speaking of water, now is the time to perfect the art of fishing. Well, fishing according to Bill Lepp. From his book, Armadillo Recon Unit and Other Tall Tales, copyright 2004, the chapter, The Art of No Hope Fishing. As far as I am concerned, the fish as an entity has not been properly villainized in lore and legend. The wolf, the snake, and the weasel have assumed places atop the list of cunning rogues and despotic tricksters in the animal world, but the fish has, as of yet, escaped depiction as a dasher of human hope and joy. Just as many animals, like wolves, snakes, and weasels, can sense fear, so fish can sense hope. Fish live to dash and destroy your hopes. They are slippery, crafty beasts who are waiting for you to want to catch them, to pin your very happiness on landing one of their kind. But all a fish wants is for you to be miserable and sad, your hopes and dreams lying around your feet like dried worms and broken driftwood. The trick, then, lies in hoping not to catch fish. Just as intelligence agents must deal in disinformation, so a true fisher person must practice dishope. My Uncle Reuben was one of the best fishermen I have ever known, and it was all due to his sour hopelessness. Uncle Reuben practiced dishope from dawn to dawn. Like many great fishermen, Uncle Reuben was also a great theologian, and was thus ready to defend his attitude of dishope with biblical references at any given moment. In fact, he was happiest when he could find no hope at all in Scripture. He would shake his sagging head and say woefully, "So you don't believe that you have to have no hope to be a good fisherman? Well, just go to the good book. Who were the disciples? They were fishermen. And who were their forefathers? The very authors of the Book of Lamentations. Those guys knew how to be distraught, and thus they caught fish. You take the story of the great catch in John 21, for example. Those guys had been in the boat fishing all night and had not caught a single thing. Then Jesus came to the edge of the water and said, 'Throw your net on the other side.' And they caught 152 fish. They were so good at being hopeless that it took divine intervention to net the fish. Now that is hopelessness. Fishermen need to get back to their roots of despair and depression." Then Uncle Reuben would frown and add, "Fish will always react counter to what you are hoping. You must learn to hope for just the opposite of what you want whenever you dare to cast your hook into the waters." I have taken this attitude to heart and studied it in great detail along the banks of many rivers and on the shores of many lakes. Fish can read your hopes like the guy at the carnival who guesses your weight. They pick up your emotional vibrations as they drift underwater, transmitted along your 10-pound test like messages over a telegraph. Fish know exactly what you want and will almost always act in direct contradiction to your wishes. To illustrate this fact, Uncle Reuben would glumly announce, "I'll bet you dollars to donuts that Jonah's last thought in the water was, 'I hope I don't get swallowed up by a big fish,' and then boom, right down the throat." Furthermore, fish can morph into completely different incarnations in the blink of an eye. Many times I have sat listlessly by a dwindling fire on a river bank, with a chunk of rotten liver lying beneath the surface, only one cast away from me,
when suddenly the grandfather of all catfish has picked up the bait and shot downstream at full speed. In my younger days, when I still openly hoped to land a record-breaking fish, I would jump to my feet, pole in hand, and steadfastly hope that I was bringing in a monster catfish. That hope would burn down the fishing line right into that fish's mouth, and then he would smile. Having deduced that I wanted to catch a huge fish, and knowing that he was indeed a trophy catch, he would morph into a log or a tire. If he was feeling particularly mischievous, he would turn himself into a giant, ugly, snapping turtle, and rise out of the water like death on a U-boat. Not only would this destroy my hopes, but it would generally leave me panicked and terrorized. I therefore set about to bury all trace of hope for fish deep within my breast. Of course, I want to catch fish. You and I know that. What sane person doesn't want to catch fish? But what we must do is convince the fish that we do not want anything to do with them, and are merely fishing out of need, as though it were a chore, like cleaning the toilet or eating vegetables. Make the fish believe that you would rather do anything but catch a fish, and they will flock to you. Uncle Reuben would say, "Now, boy, when you tie that hook onto your line, use a stout piece of loathing as a leader. And when you hook on that worm, slather it in lament as though you were buttering your morning toast." Another benefit of this attitude of earnestly pretending to hate the act of fishing is that if you were good enough at faking dishope and despair, you might even convince your spouse that you hate the sport. Then he or she will allow you to fish with a willingness equal to his or her willingness to allow you to clean the toilet. Uncle Reuben had mastered the art of dishope to the point that he would say to his wife, my dear Aunt Gullible, with a deep sigh, "No, no, honey, you stay home and weed the garden, clean the outhouse, wash the truck, and mow the lawn. I'll do the fishing." Then he would lift his rod like a soldier hefting his rifle to fight in an unwinnable battle in a lost war, and she would hug him and say, "I'm sorry, honey, that you are the one who always has to go fishing. I love you for your selfless acts of kindness to your family." Uncle Reuben was strict about his dishope rules. He would not fish with anyone who emitted positive vibes. Above the door at his fishing cabin, there hung a sign that read, "Abandon all hope of catching fish, ye who enter here." Utter any misplaced comment around the card table like, "Sure hope we catch some tomorrow," and Uncle Reuben would send you packing with a stern admonition that if you wanted to openly enjoy yourself, you could go to someone else's fishing camp. The fishing cabin itself, however, was a wonderful testament to a life spent fishing well. On the wall that Uncle Reuben called his wall of shame when in earshot of any fish, even innocent goldfish and guppies swimming dumbly about in bowls, hung the trophies of his fishing philosophy. There were 2-foot bass, trout the size of county fair first prize zucchini, a carp that you could have hollowed out to make a decent canoe, and then, on the floor, and used by Uncle Reuben as a coffee table, lay a catfish 3 inches longer than his couch. "Boys," he would say, stretching his arms wide, "I never wanted to catch any of them. In fact, the day I caught that giant catfish, I was hoping to get snagged on a log, lose my hook, and break my rod. Ruined my day when he broke the surface and pretty much jumped into my boat, laughing and croaking all the while. I would have thrown him back, except that I needed a coffee table, and he looked to be about the right size." When dawn broke, we would gather in the kitchen, and Uncle Reuben would whip us up a mess of lukewarm coffee and 6 eggs. On non-fishing days, we had hot coffee and 12 eggs for breakfast, but Uncle Reuben cut the ration in 1/2 on fishing days so that we might symbolically fast and remember our sorrow. As we filed out the door, our heads hung low, he would give us each a piece of burlap and a cigar. These were to sit on and to smoke, respectively, but they also served to remind us of sackcloth shirts and ashes. And then he would whisper, so far under his breath that it came out as soft as the belly of a bunny, good luck and good fishing. I hope you get a big one. Well, I hope you got some really great fishing pointers. But speaking of no hope, Pamela Paul shares more about blasts from the past that have no hope of a resurgence anytime soon. The next stories are from her book, 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet, published in 2021. Chapter 34, A Good Night's Sleep. Shut those bleary eyes and think back to what it was like when you could turn out the lights, knowing that everyone else, at least within your time zone, had also called it a night. There was no party after you left situation. It was just good night, people. The world stopped its incessant chatter and shut down. Only when the morning paper arrived and the commute began were we all brought back onto the same page. Think what it was like to be a teenager when you could rest assured that at a certain point every day you no longer had to fear that your friends were gathering without you or whispering behind your back. Of course they weren't. They were asleep. But who can sleep when the internet is there? There's no such thing as sleep when you're waiting for an overdue email that hasn't materialized, or when someone posted an inexplicable and upsetting comment on that photo you shared right before bedtime. Why? Just why? You will ponder it pillowside for hours, pausing from your worry to check your phone yet again for a possible explanation. It, you, cannot wait until morning. Study after study shows that using devices at bedtime results in poor sleep, which isn't good news for the 70% of adult Americans who sleep with a phone by their side. The disturbing alternative is to give up the internet for 8, let's dream a little, straight hours. But how can you do that when there's one last email you realize you need to send just as you're drifting off at 11, and then while there, why not check and see if anyone posted anything crucial? If you bolt awake at 4 a.m., you can work in a surreptitious peek and wind up doom-scrolling into the morning, appalled at both the world and yourself. Have you ever found yourself using that 4 a.m. wake-up to get ahead on the morning's email? I have. It's not our fault. Your cortisone levels are elevated when your phone is in sight or nearby, or when you hear it or even think you hear it, says David Greenfield, a professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine and founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. It's a stress response, and it feels unpleasant, and the body's natural response is to want to check the phone to make the stress go away. When you're switched on all the time, the ability to push the off button becomes not only inconvenient, but impossible. Psychologists call this continuous partial attention. It's not relaxing. If, for some reason, the internet doesn't keep us up at night, it will zing us out of bed in the morning. Here I am, it says, with a vibrating workout reminder, or an intoning chime reminding us to meditate, as it delivers the latest grim updates from around the world and tallies our unreads with fearsome notifications. 8 in 10 smartphone users check their phones within 15 minutes of waking, and, by golly, we must. If, heaven forbid, we actually slept through the night, we need to know what we missed. Chapter 33, Birthday Cards. Kid's birthday began with a dash to the mailbox, waiting for that first trickle of oversized envelopes, which often arrived days ahead of time, because what doting aunt would want her birthday wishes to miss the big day? That youthful excitement endured well into adulthood, even when the cards, purchased in museums and stationery stores no longer contained pop-ups and fold-outs, checks or stickers, but instead a more adult version of birthday deliciousness, caring notes about friendship and family. Now, birthday greetings may instead arrive in the form of emails, posts, texts, and, perhaps worst of all, e-cards, which either slip into spam where they belong, or land in unison on the morning of the big day because they were automated. However they got there, nobody wants them. Really, nobody. Ready-made and free for anyone who signs up and signs away their data, and yours, the e-card says nobody could be bothered making or buying a card of their own. There is nothing fun about the e-card, which forces you to click through several slow-to-load screens before you arrive at anything resembling a personal message. It leaves no recipient feeling seen or attended to. It feels crappy on your birthday, indifferent on Valentine's Day, brutal on Mother's Day. There may not even be an e-card if a birthday gift arrives in multiple shipments via Amazon with its sole message, a generic, "Happy Birthday, Love Grandma," printed in 10-point sans serif type on the packaging slip alongside the sterile return instructions, or if your present is an online gift card with only a line filled out with the name of giver and recipient. At least you don't have to write a real thank you note either. Chapter 19. They Forgot My Birthday. The Samantha Bakers of today will never have to endure the tragedy that befell Molly Ringwald's character in John Hughes's now wildly outdated 1984 movie, 16 Candles. Today, it's all but impossible not to know that it's someone's birthday. You cannot possibly forget. It's on the Google Calendar. Facebook sends a reminder the day before and offers a belated window the day after. The office intranet includes daily birthday updates for all staff members. You also know your friends' anniversary, and your friendship anniversary with them, and their work anniversary, which you are urged by email to congratulate them on when you next visit LinkedIn. On my most recent birthday, well before my husband or kids had a chance to say a word, I received best wishes from my bank, my dentist, my GP, and my dermatologist. These greetings arrived unsolicited via text or email, presumably because at some point in the course of the business of life, I'd filled out a form, perhaps on one of those infernal padded tablets, requiring me to enter my DOB. Several other websites, some place where I'd once bought socks for my 10-year-old, a place I'd browsed for sweatpants, chimed in with an HBD, most of them arriving in the early morn, auto-sent at 5 a.m., well before the texts and emails and balloon-filled Facebook posts appeared, many of them also from people I don't actually know. And do any of us really know other people's birthdays? If someone put you on the spot and asked you to tick off all your nieces and nephews' birthdays, or the birthdays of the people who sit in the cubicles adjacent to you every day, you'd probably draw a blank. No one bothers to remember these dates. No one keeps a little notebook of birthdays or marks them next to each entry in their address book. And because you don't even have that little address book, you don't have to periodically update it or switch it out for a new one, copying the birthdays over again, committing them to memory. Don't worry, the internet is there, all set with a birthday donation and emojis to match. Now, if only there were a way to remember the birthdays of those few people not on the internet. Chapter 21. The Family Meal. Family dinner time was sacrosanct, no matter how close or estranged the family. Now that everyone was home from work and finished with homework, it was time to ask, "How was your day?" It was time for family announcements and discussions about the weekend. Certain topics would be raised strategically in front of everyone else for maximum effect. This was when you brought up things that you wanted everyone at the table to know. It was the time for conversation about Aunt Caroline's cancer and about what to do over spring break. It was the time to sulk in fury over a plain baked potato and wan broccoli, signaling to everyone at the table just how much you didn't want to be there. And you did not leave the table without asking to be excused. May I? And it needed to be a good excuse. Naturally, that family phone always rang in the middle of dinner. Let it ring, was the prevailing ethos. Not only was it rude to pick up at dinner time, unless Grandma was on her deathbed or someone needed picking up from the train station, it was rude to call in the first place. That had better be a telemarketer. Now our phones are wired into mealtime, bringing the internet to the table. We can talk to everyone, and we can talk to one another not at all. In restaurants, people don't converse with each other while waiting for their food. Once illuminated by candlelight, the faces of romantic couples now glow from lit-up screens. We take pictures of our food and selfies of us together and ask the waiter to take a photo, please, for good measure. You don't have to wonder what that ingredient is on the menu or betrayed your food ignorance by asking the waiter. You Google. Even after we tuck into our food, we find convenient excuses to flip over the face-down phone or retrieve it from our pocket. It's only to check one thing, to verify something he said, to see if the babysitter texted, to answer the question Mom used to know the answer to but can't surface right now. It's going to drive her insane, so just one quick second, apologies. The local diner is quieter, families sitting together in front of their respective devices, eyes cast downward rather than across the table, giggling to themselves or their online companions rather than with one another. Nobody is whining about not getting to order chocolate chip pancakes for lunch or asking when the food will arrive. That's all secondary. Instead, all are content, each in their own world, like Pixar's post-apocalyptic WALL-E vision of Earthlings, stripped of musculature and humanity, reclining blobbly in automated loungers affixed to portable screens. Extracting a teenager from her phone at any meal can be such an epic struggle. It's no wonder many parents have stopped trying. Only 1 in 3 American teenagers regularly silences, turns off, or puts away her phone when visiting extended family. Of course, their parents may no longer care or even notice, because they are too busy photo-documenting the 3-course meal to demonstrate their home chef cred on Instagram. We are keto! We've gone vegetarian! We are salt of the earth and eat pork loin, but heirloom! According to one survey, only 28% of Americans ban phones from the dinner table. In an experiment conducted by the University of Virginia, 300 diners were selected at random in a cafe. Half were asked to keep their phones on the table, and the other half to put phones away. Participants were told the experiment was about dining experiences with their friends. Phones weren't even mentioned. After the meal, people were asked to rate their experiences in terms of overall enjoyment, conversation, and the food itself. Those whose phones had been put away all gave 3 metrics higher ratings than those who kept their phones out during the meal by a statistically significant factor. The meal just isn't as good. Bon appétit! Chapter 26. Productivity. What the hell are we doing all day? What the hell am I? If forced to reckon with that question, I find that a typical account of my busy, busy day means ignoring many emails and answering some, likely selected from the 68 messages I've starred in my inbox so as to warn myself that I absolutely must reply ASAP. I am usually already 2 weeks late. I am circling back to the person I touched base with last month and only now realized never replied. I am firing off requests and follow-ups. I am circling back again and yet again, my head whirling along, accidentally answering the same query twice, which requires a follow-up, oops. I zoom in and hang out with the boxy confines of Google, square-eyed with Zoom fatigue by the end of the day. Mostly, I am on Slack, which is lighting up like a 21st-century operator switchboard. As soon as I extinguish one green dot, another appears, an endless game of whack-a-mole. All this slacking makes me feel, alas, like a slacker. But I can't stop, because I've got 6 conversations going, and I am searching for the right emoji for this thread before scrolling up the next. The unreads, the unreads, the unreads. On average, employees at large companies with one of these inter-office messaging systems send more than 200 messages per week, according to one productivity analytics company. All this leads to a follow-up question. What are we accomplishing? Answer: not much. Intended to replace onerous mail accumulation, Slack and other team collaborative applications often only compound the problem. Now we've got notifications across multiple channels, and we're wondering what's going on in the channels that we're not in, but perhaps should be. Must check on that later. Chat and its various formats has gone from being a minuscule part of the day to the second most common computer activity after email. We do a lot of checking. We check our laptops, our desktops, our occasionally godforsaken voicemail when one shows up, even if only to delete the cryptic to the point of insane transcription of spam messages left in Mandarin. In one recent survey, 50% of employers said cell phones were distracting their employees. 44% of employers said the internet in general was a distraction. In another, 73% of people said technology had become too distracting altogether. What was it distracting us from? We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any humorous quotes or authors you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any comments or questions about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.